There's a myth out there that med students never fail or drop a class, and of course, all have high MCATs and they're perfect, or they don't get in. Our guest today is determined and hardworking, but she has also overcome significant challenges on the way to medical school. She doesn't fit the myth of the perfect med student, but she is a proud M2, and we're going to hear her story.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Welcome to the 390th episode of Admission Straight Talk. Thanks for joining me. Many of you now are thinking about next year's application to medical school. Do you know how to get accepted? Dr. Susie Schweikert does, and she shares her knowledge and insight in Accepted's free guide, Med School Admissions, What You Need to Know to Get Accepted. Download your free copy at accepted.com/390download. It's free. accepted.com/390download for what you need to know to get accepted to medical school. Our guest today is Santoye Douglas, a second-year MD student at Quinnipiac Nitter School of Medicine. She was born to immigrant parents from Jamaica and Nigeria and grew up in Brooklyn in New York City. From a young age, she wanted to be a doctor, but working her way through high school and college made it hard to get good grades, much less prep for the MCAT. Yet today, she is an M2. Let's hear her story of hard work and perseverance and tremendous determination directly from her. Santoye, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me today. Now, can you tell us a little bit more about your background outside of medicine? When did you start working? What do you like to do for fun?
Just to go back in time a little bit. So I did start working when I was in high school. And basically, I was working, but I was also student body president. I was also a cheerleader. I was very, very busy even from then. I think that's kind of, you know, when I started learning how to multitask, that's what kind of kicked it off in high school. Like me just learning how to be professional and how to juggle and how to run from one thing and then change into the next. But for fun, I do like to spend time with family and loved ones when I can. And when I do get the chance, because I do have a lot of family internationally, I love visiting family and trying to get away and travel. And yeah, that's basically like my release or my freest time.
Okay, great. When did you realize or how did you figure out that you wanted to be a doctor?
So from a very young age, I would just find this interest in science and it just seemed so interesting to me. And I also speak about having a very deep and robust interest in art. And I think what really solidified it for me, so as a kid, when people would ask me, I would always say, oh, I want to be a doctor. But as I started to get older and as I got into junior high school, I had this opportunity. There's this program that is no longer in New York City, but it was called the Gifted Program. And basically, it was for students who were talented and gifted and basically students that were performing, I guess, like higher on exams and stuff. So they had like special classes and things kind of worked into our schedule. So I had the opportunity to be exposed to, it was a Saturday program for anatomy, and there were models and stuff, like they brought different organs and stuff. And I had never seen any of that before. Like I knew what organs were, I knew what a heart was, I knew what a brain was, I knew what these things were, but I had never seen like models and stuff like that.
How old were you at this time?
So I would have been around 11 or 12. And seeing the models, they reminded me of sculptures and like all the colors. And, you know, they have the veins painted in blue and the veins painted in red. And
arteries are red and veins are blue. When I did those models, that's what they were.
Yes, no, that's right. The arteries are in red, the veins are in blue. And it's just seeing like the vibrancy of like, and again, real organs, you know, since being in anatomy lab, I know that that's not actually what it looks like, at least in anatomy lab, but just seeing it at that age, it caught my attention because it reminded me of a sculpture. And I think at that point, I started seeing the connections between like art and science and, and that anatomy class solidified medicine for me. And I knew at that point, that's when like, okay, I was getting ready to go into high school. And I said, I need to be in a high school that's going to help me continue this. And even on my first day of high school, my old guidance counselor and the high school secretary, they remind me every time they see me, like, I remember like your first day of school, you came in and you said that you wanted to be a doctor. And they remind me all the time now when they see me. But it was just something that I felt very strongly. And I, you know, despite anything that happened, I always just remembered having this overwhelming feeling of like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. That's kind of how like the early like interest was piqued for me.
Very nice. Okay. And what were some of the challenges you faced as a child of immigrants growing up in Brooklyn and attending New York City public schools? One advantage was you got into this gifted program, but there were also, I'm sure, challenges. And what were some of them?
Absolutely. So some of the challenges were financially, because New York City is a very expensive place to live. So at different times, there were different periods during childhood that things were tighter than they would have normally been. And there were definitely some struggles there. And I just remember like sometimes not always being able to do certain things because money was tight. And that was just one of the things. And eventually it led to me working early because I wanted to be able to not only help out a little bit at home, but to also have, you know, like to not worry my parents. So for example, my high school applications, I paid for that with my McDonald's salary. You know, that was just one of the financial components that made it harder. But it was also just hard being in a neighborhood that was underserved. So being in a neighborhood and having friends and relatives that are suffering from diseases that are preventable, but they don't have the proper access to care. And as a child, I didn't really understand that. But as I started to get older, I started to see the discrepancies between neighborhoods. And especially when you start to travel and you start to see more of the world, there's a lot of people that I grew up with that they don't have that opportunity to branch out or go away to college and have those experiences and see what it looks like in another city or another. So when I started getting those chances, I started realizing that like, okay, the way I grew up is not the way everyone else grew up, and definitely saw some of the ways that people were suffering and people were disadvantaged. So that also, I feel like, drove me to this point in life for sure.
Now, you wrote a Forbes article about being, and we'll link to it from the show notes, at accept.com/390. The article was about being the imperfect medical school applicant. In what ways were you imperfect? Apparently, nobody's perfect, but anyways, go ahead.
So in undergraduate, my GPA was not the ideal pre-medical GPA or the GPA that everyone imagines. So like a 4.0, a 3.8, that was not my GPA. And I struggled. I struggled a lot with trying to balance working and extracurriculars and still trying to get in community service and trying to build this pre-medical portfolio while trying to maintain my grades. And I think one of the things that made that process, again, more complicated was just the fact that I was also in a new setting and a new area, and I had to kind of navigate that and learn how to live in this new city. So that definitely played into that as well. But my grades were not perfect. I got C's. I failed a class. Definitely not what you would imagine as like the perfect applicant for medical school. So that's where that play on imperfect comes from, because what people imagine when they hear like, okay, a pre-medical student, they're imagining like straight A's and they're imagining, you know, hours and hours of community service and hours of medical experience and just clinical hours and those and things of that nature. And I was not that person. I definitely struggled with that balance.
How many hours were you working during, let's say, most of college? I'm not saying that, you know, I'm sure it varied at certain points, but.
Mm-hmm. On average, I want to say around 20, maybe.
That's significant.
Definitely around 20.
And you were still finding time for on-campus involvement and some volunteering?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a real rough schedule for sure.
It was very tight. And then I was also a double major in human biology and art. So I would spend hours studying for organic chemistry, and then I'd have paintings that maybe required another 5 to 10 hours, or I'd have a drawing that, you know, like some of our final projects would require 14, 15 hours of work. So it was definitely hard to balance, for sure.
Oh yeah, for sure. What did you do to overcome the imperfections, shall we say?
So in undergrad, I didn't have a blueprint per se. I didn't know what I was doing. But through a lot of research and mentors and talking to people and reaching out to people, and sometimes I literally just would speak to someone and I'd be like, oh, this would be a good person to keep in contact with. And then I'd follow up with them. And then I'd say, hey, can you connect me to this person? Like just building connections and building networks. I figured out a pathway to medical school for myself. And it wasn't easy. And I definitely had a lot of missteps along the way, but it took a lot of research and a lot of behind the scenes, literally just saying like, hey, do you know someone that can help me? Do you know someone that can give me advice? And that's kind of how I began to craft this plan. And it wasn't a perfect plan and it changed over time. Initially, I thought I was going to have one gap year. That then changed to a few gap years and a master's degree. So it definitely evolved, but I, at the core of everything, I knew what I wanted and I knew that I had to continue working towards that goal. And I wasn't easily distracted because I wanted it so bad. I wanted to be in medical school so bad. I wanted to become a doctor so bad. So even when I would have a really rough set of months or a really rough semester, I would always keep that in the back of my mind.
Now, you mentioned that you got a master's, and I believe you got it from Geisinger, right? The Master's of Biomedical Science program there. How was your experience there?
My experience there was a good experience. And I know that with the changes this year, I believe the program is currently virtual, but at my time in person, it was a good experience. The thing about this particular master's program is it's designed to make you not only more competitive for professional school, but to also build on your professional development. So I believe that was definitely accomplished within my year there. And it was a very quick year. And our semesters were packed tight, but I learned a lot and I challenged myself. And I speak about this a little bit in not only the Forbes articles, but in some other interviews that I've done, that I got A's for the first time. Like
Were you working?
No, and I wasn't. And that's what I feel like made the biggest difference, because for the first time I could focus on being a student and I didn't feel like I was being pulled in so many different directions. I was still active. I was president of two organizations and I also had a student government position, but I knew that with not having that financial responsibility or that financial stress and tension, I could finally focus on just working through what I needed to do, fixing my deficiencies in the core sciences, and learning how to study and learning how to review information in a way that would work for me and that still works for me now in medical school.
And before you got to Geisinger, when you were going through college or taking your gap year, but particularly when you were in college, so you were doing all this juggling, you were working, you were doing some volunteering. I mean, emotionally, how did that feel, dealing with the adversity and the obstacles?
At times, I felt hopeless. And that's me being completely honest. At times, it felt impossible. I remember having periods of time where I would lean so much on my support system. I would call my friends after every class that was a little rough just speaking to like that one family member that kind of like knew and understood and just really like leaning on like my support system, because it seemed like, is this going to work? Is this going to happen? Is this ever going to become true? Yeah. That feeling could be really defeating at times, but that's why it's so important to surround yourself with those reminders of this is possible. You can do this. So that for me, what that looks like is, and I speak about this a lot, like I would put up post-its around my room of just reminders of like, you can do this, you got this. And another thing is I would always remember that like, I can take it a minute at a time, not even a day at a time. I can take it minute to minute, class to class, exam to exam. And when I got to that point of like, just keep going. You got this. That's when things started to materialize. So I know that feeling of hopelessness. I have been there and it's not permanent. I think that's the key takeaway. It is not a permanent thing.
One of the things I try and convey to applicants is you can change. you can change. Now, you had external factors that you were dealing with in the sense that you had to support yourself. But once you got the opportunity, you learned how to study and improve your grades, you changed and you changed your qualifications. And that's something I think is really, really important for people to realize. Somebody I am related to is not a big fan of technology. Let's just leave it like that. And every time he says, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this. And sometimes I'll get a little frustrated and I'll say, you know, I don't know is not a terminal disease. It can be changed. Mm-hmm. So you were really, really determined and you found a way to change. And I hope that people listening, whom everybody at some point feels like, oh, this is just nothing is working, right? You can change. The world can change. There's another day. So anyway, I really appreciate you sharing that. Now, the second time around you applied to medical school, you obviously were in a very different place. Was there anything even then that you found difficult about the actual application process?
So at that point, I was out maybe a few months from my master's program. So the way how my trajectory kind of went from that point is I did the master's program and then I went straight into MCAT prep while finishing up classes for the master's program. And then after that, turned in the application while I was studying for the MCAT, which is not always advised. But at that point, I felt pretty confident in the place that I was in at that time. So after that, once my application was done, then I started working on secondaries. So the thing that I think was most daunting was just staying and keeping the energy going. Because after a 10-month intensive master's and then going straight into MCAT and then having secondaries and then having interviews, it seems like I couldn't catch my breath. But the one nice thing about that moment is that I noticed the change. The first time I applied, I literally just counted down rejections. That's what it was. It was just like...
Were you expecting them?
To a degree, yes. To a degree, yes. Because I feel like I knew that I wasn't as competitive as I could have been. So once I got the first one and the second one, I was like, okay. I started realizing like, okay, this might not happen. I might need another plan, right? But in the moment, I was like, let me just keep the hope. Keep hoping. And when I got to that like last rejection, I was like, okay, I need plan B. And I found that plan B very quickly because I was so hungry and I was so determined. But the second time around, things were a little bit different. I turned in my secondaries and then my score got released. So, and then I got additional secondaries based off of, I'm guessing, my score, which was amazing. And then just that feeling of knowing like, okay, your score got you into a few more, you know, schools kind of like radar. That's great. And I remember the day that I got that first interview invite. And I didn't get an interview the first time. So I was just like besides myself, you know, I was being emotional. I was happy. I was calling like a bunch of people like, oh my gosh, I got my first interview and I had to travel for it. So I had to arrange a flight and all this stuff. And it was just exciting. And I think that's what, even though I was tired at that point and I was kind of a little bit worn out with just the rigor of the last like year, when I got to that point where I started getting good news, I was like, okay, you are here.
Celebrate.
Deal the deal. Let's finish this off. And that was the difference.
When you got your MCAT score and you got this really good score, did you add schools to apply to at that point? Or did you just realize that your chances had improved?
Actually, I did not. And it's funny because when you get your score, if you allow your score to be released into, there's a specific term for it, but there's certain boxes that you can check while you're taking your exam to allow your score to be released to like schools. So what happened was it got released to schools and then they started waiving like the secondaries for me to apply. So I could have increased the schools. Yeah, which was amazing because that never happened before. So I could have increased the schools, but at the time I was working and I wasn't really working a job that was as financially fulfilling as it should have been. So, so with the job that I was working, I wouldn't have been able to afford the flights and everything to go to all of the schools, but it was amazing to get those. It was maybe about 10 schools that had reached out that were willing to waive the secondary. And I was like, oh, I wish I could interview everywhere, but it didn't.
It really gets tiring.
Yeah.
How many interviews did you get in the end?
So I went 5 interviews and then 2 acceptances outright and then 3 waitlist positions. Yeah.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Wow. All right. So now you're in medical school. You're accepted. You're a Quinnipiac. What have you liked best about your medical school experience so far?
So I'm going to talk about pre-COVID because...
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. Pre-COVID. Okay.
But post-COVID now is actually a little bit better. So I'll touch on that right after. So
sounds
pre-COVID,
good.
I think the first 2 weeks of medical school, I had this like unreal feeling of like, this is actually happening. I would just be sitting in class and it would hit me like a wave, like you're a medical student, you're going to be a doctor. And then they would, or I'd be in class and they'd say something like, yes, with your future patients. And I'd be like, oh my gosh, this is medical school. Like it just constantly like reminded me that like, wow, like you're here. Like this is what you have professed for years that was going to happen. And it's finally here. It's happening. So that was like the first 2 weeks. So that feeling was just great. Right.
Yeah.
But then we started getting into, so the nice thing about Quinnipiac is as first and second years, you're required to do 4 hours a week of clinical experience. So I, specifically stated that I wanted to be in an underserved community and they met that ask, which was amazing. So getting to go into clinic 4 hours a week and see patients and interact with patients and then having like patients from like similar backgrounds as me and stuff, like that experience was just unreal because here I am, like I'm doing exactly what I said I wanted to do. I wanted to be in an underserved setting. I wanted to have those experiences with people where like I understood them. And there would be times where I would just understand like without them even having to explain like what was going on. And I was able to advocate for people and say things that like, it was like, wow, like this is happening already. So that was a beautiful experience. And then another thing that has been like my favorite, which is weird because in all honesty, initially, I was very nervous about it. So with anatomy lab, at first I struggled and I didn't struggle with because I love anatomy, I didn't struggle with the actual coursework. I struggled with like the aspect of death and I struggled with understanding that, you know, this is something that I guess I never really got to process fully, like what it would be like to work with a donor. And I think over time, being in anatomy lab, I warmed up and I got better. And by the time that COVID had shut anatomy lab down, I was doing way better. And I was getting the full experience that I feel like the donor would have wanted me to have. And that is something that I am so grateful for. And I am so grateful to everyone who donates their bodies to science because just being able to learn in that manner, it has helped me so much more. Like I understand anatomy so much better.
Okay. So that was pre-COVID. COVID hit. Okay. You were not immune. I mean, I hope you were immune to COVID itself, but you were not immune to the shutdown. So what happened then?
Right. So I was actually on spring break when everything started shutting down, which was really kind of scary because I actually had classmates that were like outside of the country. And then there was this talk of like trying to get Americans out of countries and it was a scramble. And so it was a really interesting time.
A previous guest of ours, by the way, was stranded in Hawaii.
Oh my goodness. So yeah. I definitely understand that. And I was with family and I remember just all those feelings from March of like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how things are going to go. And I remember like checking the numbers every day for New York and trying to make a decision like, okay, should I go back to Connecticut? Because if my school does continue with like in person, I'm going to be stuck here. So it's like lots of little decisions. And like my brother, he was still in high school at the time. So he was still going in and out of the house every day. And I'm like, checking to see if he has a fever every time he comes home because schools are still open in New York City at that point. So I just remember it being so much like confusion and like, what do we do? And then the emails started coming in of the cancellations, and literally life just for everybody, it was a complete change and things were different and we all had to figure out how to adjust. And I went virtual and it was so weird because it was like, I had this schedule, I had a routine. I was in a rhythm, right? And then I feel like I just got knocked off that rhythm completely. And here it is that, you know, I can't leave my house. I'm ordering groceries to my house. I can't go to the gym. I can't see my classmates. We can't be on campus. Just so many like little changes and tweaks. And we were still learning and we were still practicing clinical skills. It's funny now, but in the moment it was very not funny. We had to like practice clinical skills on whatever we could find. So like I had classmates that were practicing on like dolls and stuff just to get the technique down. It was an experience for sure. But the nice thing was there was a little bit more time in my schedule because I wasn't driving to different places. So it did give me time to actually like mentor and start speaking to like different students and stuff that maybe needed help or maybe needed guidance. So that was something that I did have more time in my schedule. That's definitely a positive.
Are you back at school now?
Yes. So,
how's it now?
Now we're on a hybrid model. So we go in one day a week to meet with our, so standardized patients are called SPs. So we meet with SPs once a week and it's a one-to-one-to-one. So it's one student, one preceptor, and one SP. I go in for about 30 minutes or so. I practice my clinical skills that I'm supposed to practice that week. And then we rotate out and the next student comes in. Those students leave campus. We are back on campus. We're allowed to study, of course, with precautions and masks and hand sanitizing and just being careful. And we're also back at our clinical sites and just full PPE, well, not full PPE, but I have on a shield, I have on two masks, I have an N95. Yeah. So there's lots more precautions, but we are back at clinical sites also.
Well, that sounds a lot better. Now, outside of COVID, okay, because nobody's responsible for COVID or the COVID restrictions, what do you think could be improved in Quinnipiac?
It's hard because I didn't have a full year of...
Yeah.
So it is kind of hard to say. Yeah, I don't think there's anything specific that I would change at this time. I feel like it is hard to say because I didn't have a full year of...
Yeah, I think that's a very fair response. That's a really fair response. It's fine. How would you like your career to evolve after you finish medical school? Do you have an idea of what specialty you want to go into?
So I'm currently undecided. I am really excited because in April, we start rotation. So I'll officially be a third year. So I really look forward to getting on the wards and being able to roll up my sleeves and get in there and learn. Like that's the best feeling right now, like just looking forward to that. But I hope that I can kind of narrow things down once I get onto the wards. Because it's hard to say now, like there are so many things that I find interesting. There are things that I know that I don't think I can see myself doing also, but there are so many specialties that I'm like, oh, this is really nice, or oh, that's really cool about this. So for example, I like the work-life balance of certain specialties. So like EM, I should not use acronyms. That
Emergency medicine, right?
Yes. And I also like the excitement and the fact that, you know, it's like something new every day. That is exciting. But then my clinical site is internal medicine. And I do like having that like kind of continuity with the patient as well. I find that interesting. And I find those relationships really fulfilling. But then I think about like surgery and I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. And then there's the anatomy that comes in with that. And I'm like, oh, that would be awesome because there's so much anatomy. And so I'm torn, but I'm hoping to kind of narrow it down once I start third year.
I'm sure you will. That'll bring you some clarity. If there was something that you could redo about your path to medicine, okay, what would it be?
I would start building a network and mentors from sooner. I would have probably started from high school. And there were a few people that I knew when I started high school, like maybe one or two doctors, but I didn't really have someone to tell me, hey, like this is an option for you. I didn't learn about post-bacs and masters until my junior year of college. I didn't know those were a thing. I didn't know that they were even an option for people who don't have strong undergraduate or competitive undergraduate GPAs. Another thing that I didn't know that the fee assistance program existed. So that's through the AAMC to pay for application fees and MCAT fees. I didn't know that that existed. There are so many things that I kind of went out and found, but I found it in the moment. And I feel like if I had had someone that said, hey, do this or do that or don't do this, someone to kind of like, even if it wasn't a mentor that I spoke to every day, maybe we just checked in once a week or once a month, or I would have got to this point sooner. And I believe that everything does happen for a reason. And I do believe that your journey is kind of unique to you and things kind of fall into place when they're supposed to. But it would have been nicer to get to this point sooner. I definitely agree. And maybe I would have saved some money also, because I did apply the first time and I did take the MCAT 3 times. So if I would have saved some money also, that would have been very helpful.
When you talk about mentors, are they physicians? Are they medical students or students a couple of years ahead of you in the game, or 3 or 4 years ahead of you in the game?
So I have more mentors than I do friends. And I have mentors for every aspect of my life. If there's something that someone's doing that I think is amazing, no matter what the field is, if I think it's amazing, if it's something that I can see myself maybe also doing, I'm reaching out to that person. Even if they don't get back to me, that's fine, because I saw that thing in them that made me say, wow, like this would be great, right? And I took that chance. And if it works out, great. If it doesn't work out, that's okay too. But I believe that you can have mentors for anything. I have mentors that are a year ahead of me. I have mentors literally at every step ahead of me in terms of like Quinnipiac. So I have a mentor who's a third year and a fourth year. I have mentors who are already attendings. I have mentors who are residents. I literally have like every type. And I know it seems like it could be too much information, but I'm very specific about what I ask and what I expect of every mentorship relationship. So I go in with a goal, and I know that through this relationship, I'm communicating that this, I want to get to this goal. And if you're okay with it, can we get me to this goal together? And a mentorship can also have dual, you know, you can give also. So if it's a research relationship and you have an intention of publishing this particular research and this is an expert in the field and they decide to mentor you, you should also be willing to help them as well. So there has to be a give in a mentorship also. So I feel like you can never have too many mentors. If there is conflicting information, then it does get a little bit confusing. But most of the time, if you have a set goal, things will fall into place and you'll work on achieving that specific goal with that mentor.
Are you mentoring any pre-meds now?
Yes. I have about 31 pre-med students that...
Oh, wow.
That's
almost a full-time job.
It is, but it's fulfilling because I am the mentor that I wish that I had. And I think one thing that's important when you are a mentor is managing expectations and kind of setting a stage for how things will work in the relationship as well. So my mentees know that if I don't get back to them within 10, 15 minutes of them reaching out, I will get back to them. I won't just never, you know, reach out or never respond, or I will get back to them. And they also know that there's items that they can ask me and I'll be able to point them in the right direction. So that's something that's like expected and set up from the beginning. But I do take those relationships very seriously, because I remember what it felt like just not having information and not having guidance. And I don't want anyone to feel like that.
Thank you so much, Santaye. Thank you so much for your time. I think we're just about out of time. You've been very generous in sharing your story and insight. Where can listeners find you online to learn more about you?
Sure. So I'm on Instagram at simply_soso. That's SIMPLY_SOSO. And I also have a YouTube page at Simply Sotonye. That's SIMPLY SOTONYE. And you can reach out to me at Gmail also with Simply Sotonye. So same spelling at gmail.com.
Great. Thank you so much. We'll link to Santoye's Instagram account and YouTube channel, as well as her Forbes article and other resources related to this podcast from accepted.com/390. Listener, thank you too for joining Santoye Douglas and me for Mission Straight Talk's 390th episode. I have a final reminder and a favor. Reminder, you can download your complimentary copy of Med School Admissions, What You Need to Know to Get Accepted, at accepted.com/390download. Grab your copy now. And the favor, if you find the show worthwhile, please tell a friend about Admission Straight Talk. They'll thank you, and so do I. Thanks again for listening. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.